It is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The latest estimate from the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau indicates our state will end the current budget cycle with a more than $3 billion surplus in the general fund. The Wisconsin Technology Council proposes ways to use the surplus to grow the economy. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, which is the science and technology advisor to the governor and the legislature. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, great to be back, Kate.
So the council is an independent, nonpartisan group advising the governor and the legislature on issues around technology and science. Why weigh in on the state budget?
Well, it's you know, the most important piece of policy that you ever really see, you know, at the state level. It contains so much. Over 2 years, this current budget's going to be about $98 billion, you know, ending in that June 30th of 2025. So it's big. And one of the things we do, I mean, we do a lot of things to help with connections with entrepreneurs and investors and others, but you know, we do have a role sometimes talking about what would make sense on the policy front. And there are some areas where Wisconsin probably has an opportunity to surge ahead in some ways of some other states. So that's really the core reason. We care about what's going on in the economy and hope to provide some ideas that people can use.
Well, we're going to certainly dig in on the policy front. But in terms of surging ahead of maybe some other states, Charitable Trust last month found roughly half of Americans live in states that report short-term budget gaps, potential long-term deficits, or both. But, you know, here we see the Legislative Fiscal Bureau estimating our state having a sizable surplus when the current budget expires in June of 2025. Why has Wisconsin avoided the deficits that other states may be facing?
Well, I think a lot of those states have a common problem. The pandemic spending party that went on for several years is over. And so they're facing now a time of more sober fiscal management. A number of states blew through the federal aid almost as fast as it arrived from Washington, D.C., and sometimes ignored their own structural spending problems that dated back before the pandemic. And we've sidestepped that problem largely as a state, it's a perfect situation, but Wisconsin has done well in amassing what's called a rainy day fund. And it's also got a sizable short-term budget balance. And so for the 2 years, I mean, there are a couple of different estimates, but a number of billions of dollars. But again, that's in the context of a $98 billion two-year budget. So Wisconsin's done some good things. There are a couple of states that have dug themselves into some problems. Our friends in Illinois, for example, have one of the probably worst managed pension funds in the country, in contrast to Wisconsin, which has one of the best managed. So in Illinois, in order to take care of that, and over time, they're probably going to be seeing some tax increases. And even Minnesota, they're predicting a shortfall versus a surplus in a few years. So we're, relatively speaking, in pretty good shape.
We're talking with Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, as we look at ways to use a projected budget surplus. You can join in the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. Tom, in October, the Department of Administration projected a budget surplus of about $4 billion by the end of the current budget cycle. Why is the Legislative Fiscal Bureau now forecasting a lower amount?
Well, and I've heard different estimates as well. For mm-hmm. example, the State Revenue Secretary, Peter Barca, he came to our Board of Directors meeting in January. And the numbers he used then were that the state had a $1.8 billion rainy day fund, which is kind of the legal limit that you can put into that, and at a projected $7 billion balance for the fiscal year ending this coming June, and $3.9 billion for the year ending June 30th, 2025. So it's a fungible figure. I mean, it's going to rise and fall with the economy and tax collections, and you know, other factors. But again, it's you know, it's a share of that total $98 billion 2-year budget, which includes everything the state touches.
You write that sometimes it's necessary to spend money to make money when it comes to economic development. What investments would you like the governor and the legislature to make?
One thing that's been on the calendar, and I think a lot of people are hopeful this will pass here within the next month, is the new engineering building at the UW-Madison. That's been on the calendar for a while. There was some controversy around that, obviously, but that one could be funded in this cycle. Wisconsin's been pretty good around it competing for some federal money in a couple of areas. There's a medical tech hub proposal. The Federal Economic Development Administration wants a 10% match on that. So there's a bill in the works right now that would be for $7.5 million to match the federal dollars if that comes in.
What is a medical tech hub?
This is a way to leverage all of the different good things that are happening in Wisconsin's healthcare and medical research world. It would be focused in both Madison and Milwaukee and some other places around the state, but it's to compete for a grant through the Economic Development Administration and hence the Department of Commerce. So Wisconsin has survived a couple of rounds of competition in that already. The full grant proposal is due February 29th. And so this is something that could really focus on some of our expertise in personalized medicine and other research areas.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of businesses or research areas could a tech hub like this nurture?
Oh, I think, personalized medicine is that notion of being able to hone in. Let's say, you know, you, Kate, have a specific ailment that it might be treated in a way that's not the same way I might be treated,
mm-hmm.
but it could be, you know, everything from medical technologies on the digital end, just, you know, a wide range. And so it really does focus on the fact that Wisconsin does have some great research in places like the Medical College of Wisconsin, the UW-Madison, UW-Milwaukee, Marquette. There's the research end, but then there's an applied end through different institutions around the state. So it's survived some good competition so far, and now it's lumped in with folks the likes of Johns Hopkins and the Mayo Clinic. So it'll be exciting to see if Wisconsin pulls ahead on that. But that's one thing that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
The state has also done well in terms of early round competition for National Science Foundation grants that also may require some matching dollars moving ahead. One is centered in water technology and the intersection of water, energy, and manufacturing,
okay.
Three areas where Wisconsin has some expertise, obviously, and the other is around sustainable agriculture. So those are two things that are poised to do well in the next year or so. And if there's just, you know, a relatively small amount of matching dollars, that will improve our chances.
Tom Still leads the Wisconsin Technology Council. That's a group advising the governor and the legislature on science and technology issues. You can call in with a question, share your views at 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Technology Council highlights the positive fiscal position of our state and proposes strategies to spend down a multi-billion dollar general fund budget surplus that could help grow the economy at the same time. Call in with a question, share your views, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Tom Still with us, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Let's bring in Dawson in Arcadia. Dawson, hi.
Hello. I was wondering if some of the surplus, is it feasible for it to be able to be invested into more rural areas, whether it be to lure some industries to revitalize some communities that are kind of left behind rather than the cities?
Dawson, thank you for the question and the comment. Tom, go ahead.
I certainly think and hope so. You know, when you look at that, some parts of Wisconsin are more prosperous than others. It's that simple. And I think one of the things that the legislature is thinking about a lot, and who knows, Governor Evers may be open to this as well, is there's a variety of tax cut ideas out there, one of which could increase the what would be called the retirement subtraction for many people who are retired. So, you know, one way to do that and return some money is through a tax cut. There are other programs, I think, that are really more focused on rural areas, I think, especially in agriculture and broadband, things that can just, you know, stir the economy there. There are a variety of Main Street programs that sometimes could probably use a little more attention. So, you know, Wisconsin's a state with a lot of different profiles, both urban and rural. And so, you know, it would be interesting to see what other ideas pop up.
So a budget surplus or a partial surplus that is returned to taxpayers, does that grow the economy, whether you're in a rural or urban area?
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, a lot of legislators would argue that one of the best ways to stimulate the economy is to bring the tax burden down. Now, Wisconsin has done a lot in recent years to improve its tax burden overall, as compared with other states. But I'm sure that there are folks who would say that you know, it needs to be even better. So that's, you know, one way to do it. And a lot of legislators would say that's an effective way. But, you know, at the same time, you don't want to spend down the entire surplus, as I noted, because you want to remain in a great position economically as we move ahead. But at the same time, there's room for, you know, targeted programs that could help with the economy, as well as some way of reducing the tax burden equitably around the state.
I want to dip into venture capital here and angel investing. The publication Wisconsin Inno reported last month that venture capital being raised in the state dropped by more than half in 2023 to $261 million. And the amount of venture capital in 2022 also fell from the previous year. How problematic is this drop in funding for startups and new businesses?
Well, first of all, those numbers are wrong, because we collect them every year in terms of angel and venture capital in Wisconsin. In 2022, the total raised and invested in Wisconsin companies was $640 million.
Okay.
In 2023, it's going to come in around $470 million, down, and certainly well down from 2021, which was the biggest year ever. That was $869 million. But it's tough to dig out those figures, and they're not, you can't get them in one source. So I'll start with that. But overall, the nation has seen the same thing. We track the national economy in terms of what's happening in angel and venture capital. We do a lot of things to try to spur the investment of those kinds of dollars in many ways, and including attracting out-of-state dollars. But, you know, it was down in 22, it was down in 23, but not to the levels that are mentioned in that NO report.
So what would boost those levels? How could you keep like this type of money from going to the coasts?
Well, you know, historically, it's always been centered on the coast, as you know, and a lot of things have happened over time. Wisconsin enacted its qualified new business venture tax credits in 2005. It created the Badger Fund of Funds in 2013. A lot of things have contributed to the growth in that. And coming on board soon will be a smallish $50 million fund that it will be managed by the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. They're still trying to pull that all together. I think there'll be some more investment coming in the Badger Fund of Funds. But largely, it's going to be, you know, private dollars that find good ideas, good deals in Wisconsin.
Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. As we talk about how to use projected budget surplus and how to grow our state's economy, you can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Carol in Milwaukee. Carol, hi.
Hi, good morning. I think today there are so many problems that are just growing. And I think to have that kind of money, I think we should look in a negative direction and try to get, or look positively, try to do something positive in this negative area by getting more. Well, there could be many things that could be done with that money, but one would be more nursing schools, so we could get more nurses. Another one would be help get more psychological help for students and for anyone who has these psychological depression problems, where there's so much more drug use and also suicide, and also regenerative agriculture to help us to save the soil that we used to have in Wisconsin.
Carol, thank you for that. Several areas there, Tom, nursing, mental health providers, and regenerative agriculture.
Yeah, that's a broad spectrum, obviously. Nursing, I think the nursing shortage is being felt in this state as well as many others. Again, this is something that really, I guess, was really exacerbated by the pandemic. And we're not out of it yet. There's also some generational issues there too. So that's one that I know a lot of people are trying to focus on. The notion of sustainable agriculture, that is indeed, I talked earlier about the National Science Foundation grant, and there's been a small planning grant here in Wisconsin for that. That is a huge area. Obviously, it's a sweet spot for the state, has been for generations. And there are a lot of things at play that I think could make our system of farming and food production even more effective than it is. So those are two areas that I think are really interesting. Now, at the same time, I think a lot of people are concerned both in the legislature and elsewhere about mental health in the state. And I think that's getting some renewed attention in many quarters.
We talked with the dean of UW-Oshkosh's business school last week, looking at the university's new School of Informatics. And Frank Braun said the state's universities are looking to reorganize their majors based on career clusters to better serve the state.
Any organization that faces an economic challenge, it causes to rethink, restructure, and renovate the way in which you do things, the way in which you operate, interact with each other, and engage the community.
Tom, how effective are the universities of Wisconsin at creating good jobs and preparing students for meaningful careers?
I think they are quite effective. I mean, they're going through, as noted, they're going through reorganization themselves. There may be, you know, some of the two-year campuses are under strain, and there's probably going to be some the possibility of other closings. But at the same time, Wisconsin's public universities are, I think, reacting to the new economy and the new world out there for careers and other, you know, pieces as well as they can. There's always room for improvement. And by the way, we have great private colleges and universities that are doing the same thing. They're probably even quicker on their feet in some ways because demographics means that they have to work harder to attract people.
Tom, I just want to thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kate.
Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to a request from Jen in Eau Claire, we explore legislation that would affect Wisconsinites who sell homemade goods.
I just wanted to bring attention to the community of cottage bakers that are in Wisconsin. There's actually a bill being proposed currently. It's Bill 897, and it would legislate our ability to generate revenue. And we're all kind of rallying right now.
Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Joby Murray is board president of the Wisconsin Cottage Food Association, a pastry chef and owner of Joby Bakes in Glendale. Joby, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate.
So your organization represents cottage food producers, and so these people may include bakers and farmers who sell the homemade, homegrown, small batch food. Can you start out by explaining how are cottage food producers allowed to operate under current state law?
Yeah, so currently we don't have a state law. We operate under a judge's ruling from 2017 that just made it not illegal or unconstitutional to sell baked goods, non-hazardous baked goods, out of our kitchens. So we're still really limited. We can't sell things that require refrigeration or items that are not baked. But thanks to a judge's ruling, before 2017, it was completely illegal even to sell a cookie out of your kitchen, which could have been punishable by time in jail or a fine. So we've made quite strides in the last 7 years.
So is it true, like, only flour-based baked goods are, like, exempt from having to have, like, a home baker license?
The key is that it has to be baked. So it has to be baked in an oven in a closed system that requires heat, because that's really the thing. When the original lawsuit was written, that was included as being non-hazardous baked goods. So granolas and things like that, or macarons that don't use traditional AP flour, are still legal.
And so, as you were saying, in 2022, your organization wins the second court victory, and it says that the government shouldn't prevent people from selling homemade shelf-stable foods directly to consumers. The state has appealed that ruling.
Yep.
So what non-hazardous products can be made and sold in Wisconsin by cottage food producers?
Yeah, so it starts getting really tricky. With the appeals, there's things like stays that allow us or don't allow us. So we kind of went through some tricky times at the beginning of 2023, but we're currently back to the same status that we were in 2017. So it's just baked goods right now until we get the appeals through the courts. So it's lots of long judicial waiting. So right now it's still just baked goods. If we can win the appeal and we kind of get this lawsuit, the second lawsuit, settled, then it'll be things like roasted coffee beans, dried pastas, Rice Krispie treats, chocolate dipped pretzels, hot cocoa bombs, all of the other things. Marshmallows would be a big one as well. Items that you think of as being shelf-stable and non-hazardous and a very low risk to consumers, but just don't go in an oven.
Okay. So then we get to this bill. Last month, a hearing was held for Assembly Bill 897 that would add regulations for cottage food producers making more than $20,000 in sales, and they would be required to get licensed by the state and work out of commercial kitchens. What is your view on this proposal?
Yeah, so the bill actually limits us up to $20,000. So we would be able to run our businesses out of our homes up to $20,000. Once we hit a $20,000 revenue cap, then it'd be up to the state to determine what those next steps were. And the bill isn't clear as to what that looks like. So it could be maybe as simple as like a regulation that or an inspection, but it could be something like requiring us to have a commercial kitchen after the $20,000 cap. So it would really limit our abilities as home bakers to run profitable businesses out of our homes and utilizing our available resources of our home kitchens. So that's a really big, the bill was just very unclear on a lot of different things, but the revenue cap was really the biggest sticking point for us.
Joby, did you see this type of legislation coming?
Yes and no. So they started with legislation about 10 years ago in 2013. And this legislation looks very similar to what was proposed back then. This legislation is the pickle bill, which is currently the law, the pickle law, that limits producers of high acid canned goods to $5,000 in revenue. Whereas right now, baked goods have no revenue cap because we have no laws. So we can have unlimited revenue. So this is the pickle bill. An update to the pickle bill is really what this is.
We're talking about home-based food producers with Joby Murray, president of the board of the Wisconsin Cottage Food Association and a self-employed pastry chef. Call in with questions. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So a decade later, I mean, you call this the pickle bill. What type of license do you need for pickling or canning out of your home?
You don't up to $5,000 in revenue, which again, when you think about like how many cans of or jars of pickles you need to sell to reach that cap, it's not that many pickles. Mm-hmm. So it really limits producers, especially farmers who are trying to add value to their vegetables and to extend their selling season. It's really limited a lot of growers and producers with such a low revenue cap on the pickle bill. So with that, makes it really challenging for anybody to have a viable business option.
I didn't even think about that the value-added agriculture component. I mean, if you have a little store on your farm, mm-hmm. you would really have to watch your revenue in order to stay under those caps.
Right. Yeah, it is. It really restricts the economic growth and development of rural communities. And that's what this $20,000 cap would do as well, would really limit farmers markets, for example, and their ability to have vendors come in. Because if vendors are worried about hitting that cap, they're not going to sign up for markets or they're not going to be available. And markets are going to then struggle to find somebody who can come in and fill a gap or a need in the community.
How do these caps compare to other states?
Yeah, so more than half of states don't have a revenue cap at all on cottage baked goods. They leave it up to the individual business owners to decide when that to take a next step, like finding a commercial kitchen or finding a retail space. Or, you know, they're allowed to produce what they need or in order to supplement their own incomes or to fit into their lives as they see fit. So, and the $20,000, the ones that do have limits, for Wisconsin, $20,000 would be the lowest in the country.
So if all sales also must be direct to customers, does that put additional boundaries on where you can sell these home-baked products?
Yeah, not right now. So currently, under the judge's ruling, we are just direct to consumer. So we cannot wholesale. So like putting our items at a restaurant or a coffee shop or at another store is not allowed under our judge's ruling. So those are things that would require a commercial kitchen. So many of our bakers have found that they want to go into wholesale, and they do then expand into a commercial kitchen. So, but they have that customer base, they have that experience and the business acumen that really helps them to be more successful when they get into a commercial kitchen, because they have a dedicated client base, they have a product that people love, and their success is just going to be exponentially better than someone that is testing a market or trying to figure it out after they get into a commercial kitchen.
But there's risk. I mean, wouldn't you have to make a sizable investment and scale up pretty big if you're going to, you know, be in a commercial kitchen?
Yeah, definitely. That is one of the challenges, is that I think that we need to look at, why is the cost of a commercial kitchen so expensive? And what is that doing to our, to the industry, the baking industry and the food industry in general, that is really preventing innovation and new people coming to market? It's not, we shouldn't punish cottage bakers for being able to utilize the resources they have in their home, but we should really question, why are commercial kitchens so expensive, and do they need to be this expensive?
So last month, an editorial in the Courier Sentinel, the weekly newspaper in northwestern Wisconsin, argued that home-based sellers maintain an unfair advantage over brick-and-mortar sellers. What is your response to that argument?
Yeah, it's laughable. We really, the idea that me making cookies out of my home is somehow competing with the grocery stores is... Yeah, I mean, I'm not taking business away from Walmart or large box retailers that are making cakes. There's a niche that needs to be filled. And in a lot of small towns, there aren't brick and mortar bakeries. So you don't have the opportunity to even walk into a store and buy fresh baked bread because the scalability and the cost associated with that just isn't viable. So we really need to rely on our neighbors and our farmers and our local entrepreneurs to fill those gaps that are left in the marketplace. And consumers are proving that they do want to know where their food comes from, that they want to know who their producers are and who the bakers are and who's making their bread, and being able to have a conversation with them at a farmer's market, or just when they're ordering a cake, to have that one-on-one customer experience that you're not going to get from a large retailer.
Carry on. Go ahead.
I think that was the answer.
Pastry chef Joby Murray is board president of the Wisconsin Cottage Food Association. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts about Wisconsin food code and regulations for home bakers. The number is 800-642-1234. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the regulation of homemade food products here in Wisconsin and legislation afoot that could affect the profits of cottage bakers. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have pastry chef Joby Murray, who is board president of the Wisconsin Cottage Food Association. Joby, the proposed legislation defines, quote, non-potentially hazardous food that could be sold. Do the products now made and sold by Wisconsin cottage food industry meet that definition of non-potentially hazardous?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
So there wouldn't be any changes in that aspect.
Right. Yeah, we're not asking for those to sell things like cheesecakes or bacon or chicken pot pies at this point.
Are there any changes that would affect labeling of these products?
Yeah, so currently we don't, because we don't have any regulations, there is no requirements for labeling. As the association, we've worked really hard to encourage bakers to utilize labeling that adhere to similar standards through other states. So that includes how to contact the maker, the name of the product, the ingredients, and the allergens as well.
You know, can Wisconsin Cottage Bakers like sell their goods over the internet? Like, what is that domain like?
Yeah. So right now, absolutely. A lot of us get our orders through word of mouth and then have people do online orders as well. And again, it opens up for winter opportunities for people at farmers markets where you're not at a market maybe in the winter. You can offer online ordering through the off season or through like your CSA on a farm. So those are great opportunities for bakers. But the new bill, the proposed bill, doesn't mention anything about online sales. So it gives us great pause to not know if it would be included or not included. But it's not clear in the language of the bill.
So it's unclear in the language of the bill whether any type of online internet sales would be going toward this revenue cap,
Well, just that it'd be allowed. It would even be allowed.
Okay.
Right. Like, wow. We're at the point where we don't even know if we could. If this bill passed, we wouldn't know. And that's what concerns us.
Well, let's turn to your home business, Joby Cakes, LLC. You're selling custom cakes and treats. How do you currently connect with customers?
Yeah, so lots of word of mouth. I focus on kids' birthdays and family celebrations. And with three young kids of my own, I have access to lots of children. So that really helps. So it's just kind of, I've been in business now 5 years. So I've really been able to build up a reputation of making modern and whimsical cakes. And so it's worked out really well for me.
What would your next step be in terms of growing your business?
Yeah, it's tough. There are definitely some days where I want out of my front room where I do most of my work. And it'd be nice to have my own space. But then there's other days where I have a traveling husband or kids that are off of school for a day or even for the summer where it's just such a great resource to be able to bake at night when everybody's in bed or be up and here in the morning to get everybody to school and then here when everybody gets home from school. So for my life, it's such a great balance between being able to have a business and be a successful business owner and deciding what success means to me is the biggest thing, is that I don't want the government to say that I can't have my business out of my house once I hit a certain revenue. I feel like that's my choice and my decision as to when I'm ready for that next step or when that opportunity comes and presents itself versus feeling like I'm forced into having to leave what is working for me as a business owner.
How would this bill affect bake sales by nonprofit organizations?
There's no mention of anything about nonprofits. So currently it is in the law. I can't tell you which one, but it is in the law that bake sales are allowed for nonprofits and churches and schools and things like that. They can sell anything. So they can sell any item, hazardous or non-hazardous, as long as it's for a nonprofit.
Have you been able to talk with lawmakers about this proposal and what's on the table here?
Yeah, it was really nice. I was very impressed with all of our cottage bakers who showed up at the Capitol for the public hearing. It was so wonderful to see us rally around each other and really know that this is our livelihoods and this is our futures that are in the hands of legislators right now. And it was just really just heartwarming to see us all there together. So we have had some meetings with the co-sponsors of the bill and also with a couple other members from the committee. So kind of voicing our concerns about the things that we're kind of talking about today.
How do you rally around each other in the cottage food area since it seems like a very much an independent, person-to-person type of business?
Yeah. We've got some of the most amazing women that started this fight way back in 2013 that just wanted to be able to sell muffins. They owned Airbnb or like bed and breakfasts, and they could serve their muffins and scones in the morning to the breakfast guests. but they couldn't sell them to the guests to take home with them. And that really bothered them. So the original plaintiffs in the case, they worked really hard at creating this community that I've now had the honor to kind of spearhead and lead. So a lot of the work was really done before I got involved, but we have a very active Facebook group of 2,800 members. We have a Facebook following on our webpage, and we also send out newsletters kind of updating our association members with information about the bill or bills that are coming around now, and also to keep everybody updated on the status of the lawsuits that we've been in the middle of.
Joby Murray is president of the board of the Wisconsin Cottage Food Association as we talk about home-based food producers and legislation. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Joby, what would a better, comprehensive, sustainable law regulating the sale of homemade food, what would that look like to you?
It's really hard to say. So we've looked at Iowa has a great kind of template that we would love to use, that they have not had. They don't have a revenue cap. They've had the law around for about 20 years. So it's been proven through that state to be safe for consumers and for producers. And so the big thing is zero revenue cap. And then kind of from there, it's kind of negotiation. We'd have to work with our lawyers because we've won the lawsuits to make sure that anything that would be in the bill would be considered constitutional. So it's kind of we'd be open to options. It's hard to say, though. I can't say one way or the other what.
Yeah. So when you look to Iowa, though, what stands out to you in terms of how, you know, cottage baking would be different there?
Yeah. So it's, there's no revenue cap is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no inspection of kitchens when you're operating, when you're selling just non-hazardous baked goods, because per the FDA, they've been deemed non-hazardous. So there's no need from a food safety standpoint to have kitchen inspections. So that's a big one. Then if there was, they also have then kind of a second tier that would allow home producers to sell hazardous baked goods or to wholesale their items. And then that would require a commercial, like a kitchen inspection, not a commercial kitchen, but it would require a kitchen inspection and some additional regulations of making sure that things are time temperature safe in that way.
Joby, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for bringing this to light and letting everybody hear kind of where we're coming from.
Joby Murray is board president of the Wisconsin Cottage Food Association, pastry chef and owner of Joby Bakes in Glendale. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Auto shows like Chicago and Milwaukee this month showcase a diverse range of electric vehicles poised to redefine our roads. And we learn about the latest models and car brands that may offer incentives or excess inventory on lots. Call in with a question. You can share comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jamie Page Deaton is editor-in-chief of Car Talk. Jamie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So Chicago Auto Show kicked off Saturday, showing off concept and debut and production vehicles. What cars are you most excited to test drive this year?
Oh, this year, there are so many cars that I'm so excited to get behind the wheel of. One that I just have right now out in my driveway is the 2024 Chevy Corvette. It is a monster sports car, so fast, so fun. And then just from like a per dollar basis, such great performance for the money, even though it still starts at $70,000. The performance is in line with cars that cost, you know, over $100,000 there. But beyond that, you know, specifically, you know, from the Chicago show, traditionally speaking, the Chicago show has been all about trucks and work vehicles. And there are a lot of great trucks on the market right now. It's almost impossible to, you know, buy a bad one. I'm a huge fan of the Ford Maverick, the Ford F-150 Lightning, the Toyota Tacoma. I mean, you name it, there's a great truck out there for kind of any type of buyer.
And Car Talk named the best trucks available to buy in 2024. You mentioned the Ford Maverick was named as the staff's best small truck. What makes it the best?
It's just an extremely practical vehicle. The Maverick is actually built on a car platform, which means that it's not going to be able to tow or haul as much as, you know, a big truck like the F-150 or even a mid-sized truck like the Chevy Colorado. But, you know, what it really is excellent at is what most people actually use trucks for, which is as daily drivers. They might put, you know, a mountain bike or a kayak or two in the back, you know, and they aren't really, you know, most people who drive a truck, they don't really need all that power all the time. You know, they're not always towing a boat or a camper behind them. In a lot of ways, large trucks have become kind of lifestyle vehicles. But the Maverick is a great utilitarian, very affordable truck that starts at about $22,000, that has excellent fuel economy, very comfortable and practical inside, that just makes it, you know, it does exactly what it was designed to do. It's really practical. And if you're considering a truck and you don't need it, you know, for massive towing, maybe you just need it to do some yard work, or if you've got some, you know, outdoor kind of camping stuff that you like to do, really check out the Maverick, because it's going to be much more affordable and easier to live with than larger truck would be.
But can't the cab be pretty limited in terms of carrying around like a family or something like that? What's changing inside the cab?
Well, inside the cab is still pretty roomy. I mean, okay. I put my family into it. Like the thing that does kind of hold the Maverick back, I will say, from being practical, is let's say you've got a family of four like I do. Once they're all in the cab and you're going to, say, Costco or Sam's Club, everything you buy needs to go in the bed. So that makes it a little bit less practical, particularly if it's cold or snowy or rainy and you don't want to have your stuff out in the bed. But that's something that can be fixed with a, you know, with a bed cap or a tonneau cover. And so you can still get all the practicality out of it. And it basically drives like any other family car, except, you know, you can put mulch in the back.
Jamie Page Deaton with us, editor-in-chief of Car Talk, as we talk about the latest models and car brands of 2024. You can join in with questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So Stellantis, the parent company of Chrysler and Dodge, they withdrew from the Chicago Auto Show. What does that mean that one of the three major U.S. automakers has bowed out of a show like Chicago?
You know, I think a lot of people will read a lot into this, but ultimately it comes down to return on investment. Auto shows are incredibly expensive for the automakers. In some shows, like if you look at, you know, the Detroit show, for example, it's like $1 million just to have a press conference there. These shows are major moneymakers, you know, for the community that's having them. And so, you know, you can save a lot of money by not being at the show. And when you're a brand like Stellantis that has a lot of sub brands, you know, you're talking about Ram, you're talking about Dodge, you're talking about Jeep, you're talking about Chrysler, that is a huge amount of floor space. That's a huge amount of logistics that they have to deal with in terms of moving vehicles in, planning, you know, their show area, their stand, moving staff into support. And ultimately, you know, it comes down to, does the company feel like they will get out of the show more than what they put into it? And that appears to be the call that, you know, Stellantis made. I have to say, I was really surprised to hear it, because Chicago is such a truck and SUV show. To leave out, you know, Ram and Jeep out of those, you know, away from those buyers there, that was an interesting call to me. I'm not sure that I would, you know, I would have made it. But, you know, I also don't have access to all the data that Stellantis does. So obviously they saw that it just really wasn't worth the investment that they were looking at putting into it. That also allows them to participate more fully at other shows throughout the year. So, you know, the New York Auto Show is coming up. That allows them to put more money into that show or the LA Auto Show in order to get, you know, a little bit more publicity there than they maybe would at Chicago, because a lot more automotive press tends to go to, you know, the New York show or the LA show. So this also allows them a little bit of extra time to prep for those shows and get ready there. But just overall, it's a little bit surprising given some of their brands. But if they see that they're not going to get out of it what they're going to put into it, then, you know, it makes financial sense for them to skip.
Auto shows, they often put these concept vehicles on display. And then, you know, last month, Hyundai unveiled a concept car called the Mobion, which can turn its wheels upwards of 90 degrees. What should drivers take away from these concept cars?
I mean, you know, just first, just take in the fact that they're so crazy. I mean, that is really, like, that's number one. Just look at and kind number of marvel one. At what the engineering can do. That's what's super cool about the concept cars. But beyond that, you can look at what kind of technology might be, keyword might be, coming down the line in, you know, the next 10 years or so. And you can see in some cases how cars were really inspired by the concept car. And some cars, you know, go into production without a lot of variation from the concept. But other cars, you know, the concept car is a little bit of a dead end. It's a little bit of, you know, design and engineering kind of showing off what they can do that gets the car company a lot of publicity, but ultimately doesn't end up doing a whole lot for the car company, actually, right? Like, they don't actually end up using the design. They might take one or two things from them. But it is just really cool to see, you know, what the automaker thinks that they can do. So, for example, and this was years and years ago, there was a Cadillac concept that was showing off, you know, automatic front braking, which right now is, you know, pretty commonplace on new cars. Yep. But at the time, it was, you know, it was mind-blowing. So it's really just cool as a driver to see, like, hey, that would just be, you know, so cool to have. Look at that, you know, look at what those wheels can do. Look at this design. It's so out there. It's so fun. And then maybe some of it will trickle down, or at the very least, a lot of what we see concept cars doing is, you know, they'll show up in movies, especially if they're set in the future. iRobot had some concept cars in there. So, I mean, if you look at a sci-fi movie, sometimes the concept cars get recycled a little bit, but ultimately just enjoy them because they're cool.
Editor-in-chief of Car Talk, Jamie Page Deaton. Cool to Us, our guide to new and used cars and features to consider. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The average transaction price of a new vehicle was nearly $49,000 in December, and that is according to research firm Cox Automotive. As hundreds of new vehicles are on display at the Chicago and Milwaukee auto shows this month, we check in with Car Talk's editor-in-chief, Jamie Page Deaton, to get the latest on features, incentives, and inventory. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Mike in Rice Lake. Mike, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I bought a Chrysler 300 some years ago. It's just a V6, but I get 32, 33 on the highway. I've taken on several long road trips. I've gotten 32 at 35 miles an hour through all of that. And I know they discontinued it after this year, and I'll be looking to get another one.
You'll be looking then to get a used one, perhaps?
Yeah, buying new is just not doable.
Not doable.
So I'll be buying a used one for sure.
Yeah. The Chrysler 300, Jamie, what insights do you have there?
You know, that's a large sedan from Chrysler. It's very, I've got to say, very stylish. But you're right, they stopped making it. And this continues a trend from almost every automaker out there. Well, you'll notice they're not making cars anymore. They're just making, you know, crossovers, SUVs, trucks. If you're likely to find an actual car, it's more likely to be a sports car than your, you know, traditional sedans. In fact, you know, the domestic car makers aren't making cars anymore. They're just not doing them at all. Like Chevy is discontinuing all of them except the Corvette. Ford has the Mustang and that's it. And then if you look at, you know, Ram, that's all trucks. Dodge, they're moving purely into SUVs. And so it's getting really difficult just to find a car if you like a big, comfortable sedan like the Chrysler 300. And that's why, you know, a lot of buyers, even cost aside, you know, they might be able to afford a nice, you know, big sedan, but they just aren't available on the new market unless you're moving into foreign cars and luxury cars. So it's a little bit of a disappointing trend if you like cars and the actual, you know, sedans and station wagons as opposed to crossovers and SUVs. But this is just automakers figuring out that crossovers, SUVs, trucks are much more profitable for them than cars are. So they're moving away from them.
What will happen to the future Toyota Camry, for instance, which to me, like when I think of sedans, I mean, that to me is the one that comes up.
Well, the Toyota Camry, luckily, Toyota hasn't really moved away from cars. They still have the Corolla. They still have the Camry. Honda still has the Civic and the Accord. Mm-hmm. And so really, it's mainly the domestic automakers that are moving away. I should also say, too, a lot of luxury brands are keeping their cars, you know, BMW and Audi and Cadillac and things. But, you know, if you're looking for a sedan, you're going to have to go to a foreign automaker because the domestics just aren't doing it anymore. And part of that is because, you know, when the foreign automakers, you know, they're playing in other markets, in other markets, particularly Europe and Asia, you know, cars are much more common than they are here. American drivers really like their SUVs and their trucks.
Okay. So, you know, as we scan inventory lots, are you seeing that those lots are full? Are supply chain issues of the pandemic gone, or do they still prevail?
So they've mainly gotten out of the system, which is great. No more waiting. You know, if you had to take your car in for repairs, I mean, it could have been months in the middle of the pandemic before they got the parts you needed. And so those pandemic era supply chain kinks have been kind of worked out. And the nice thing is, you know, we're seeing normalcy return to the new car market, but people really do need to understand that it's a new normal. Cars are much, much, much more expensive than they have been in the past. As you noted, coming back from the break, I mean, the median car price is $49,000, which is insane when you think about it. But given that there's a lot of safety features packed into new cars, given that Americans overall are trending towards buying larger, more expensive cars, because that's really what's on offer from automakers, it does make sense. But the nice thing I will say about all of the normalcy kind of returning in terms of supply to the new car market is that normalcy is returning to the used car market, which is where most people buy their cars. And so for the, you know, for a long time during the pandemic, the used car market was flooded with buyers who couldn't get new cars because of the supply chain issues. And also because of the new car supply chain issues, that was limiting the supply of used cars coming to the market. Now that's all been largely worked out and we're seeing used car prices come down, which is great if you're somebody who, like all of us, you know, really needs to shop within a budget. You're going to find lower prices on used cars than you have in the past couple of years, more selection. So if you've been waiting to buy a new to you car, your waiting has paid off.
I wonder, amid this normalcy, are manufacturers in the mood to offer any generous incentives for their vehicles? Mm-hmm.
Not really.
Okay.
Part of that is because, if only. You know, the automakers have gotten really, really good at managing their supply chain so that they don't get, you know, too many cars sitting on the lot. That's what really causes, you know, an oversupply is what causes all those great discounts. And automakers don't want to do that anymore because they're covering those a lot of time with finance money and interest rates are really high. And so, you know, a lot of the deals that also people used to get was on financing, you know, 0% financing for 5 years. Those deals are happening less and less and less than they used to because just overall interest rates are up. So if you're looking for a deal on a car now, you're probably not going to get it. But the good news is you're not going to likely pay, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 over the asking price like we were seeing, you know, in the pandemic.
In the more movement and options in the used front, I wonder, is there any impact from the whole online shopping for cars, the Carvana vroom, the CarMax effect? Is that impacting the online marketplace, or I'm sorry, the used marketplace?
You know, they're still not a big part of the used marketplace. Okay. The majority of the used marketplace is still at brick and mortar dealers. That said, I mean, from a consumer standpoint, having these great nationwide options it just makes life a lot easier, you know, because you can shop nationwide as opposed to just whatever's down, you know, on the corner in the town that you're in. And you're also able to compare prices. And if you have a car to sell, you know, CarMax and Carvana, they really do make it easy. You know, you can enter your VIN, you can get an estimate. And even if you're not intending to sell your car with them, that gives you a backup amount so that if you're going to a dealer and looking to trade your car in, you can tell if you're getting a fair offer there. So the biggest impact I would say is they're bringing more information to the consumer, and you know, a consumer that's got more information is going to make better choices in the long run. So overall, I'd say it's good just simply from that information effect.
Jamie Page Deaton with us, editor-in-chief of Car Talk, as we examine the latest models and car brands of 2024. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Jamie, in November, Tesla started fulfilling orders for its new Cybertruck, and the company says the all-wheel drive version of the vehicle can drive from 0 to 60 miles per hour in under 4 seconds and has a range of 340 miles. What do you think of Tesla's foray into the truck market?
I mean, it's certainly interesting. I saw that Kim Kardashian has one, and you probably wouldn't consider her to be your average truck buyer. I don't see her throwing bales of hay in the back of her Cybertruck. But, you know, the Cybertruck is really divisive, to be honest. If you haven't seen this, highly recommend, you know, anybody listening, go and Google it quickly. It looks kind of like a doorstop, super futuristic looking. And this is a truck that Tesla touted for years. Frankly, a couple years ago on Car Talk, we named it our best imaginary truck because it really looked like Tesla was not going to be able to bring it to market in a way that would be legal to drive on American roads. But overall, you know, like a lot of Teslas, it's very futuristic. It's super fast. It's very attention getting. And, you know, it's not necessarily going to be, you know, the most practical truck out there, although Tesla says it can tow up to 11,000 pounds, which is on par with a lot of large trucks. You know, that speed from 0 to 60, like, please don't test that on public roads. That should only be done, you know, on a track. But one great thing about it is being an electric truck, and this is in line with the electric Chevy Silverado and the Ford F-150 Lightning, which is also electric, it makes it really good for towing. Because electric vehicles have 100% of torque on demand, whereas with a gasoline engine, you have to wait for the engine to kind of spool up before you get all the torque. So it's much easier to get the car and everything you're towing or everything in the bed moving from a stop with an EV, an electric truck. And Tesla's now playing in that space. You know, I have not been behind the wheel or anything of a Cybertruck, but early reports are that it's a little bit difficult to drive. It takes a little bit of extra attention. But if you want the attention that one will get you, then, you know, it's certainly an option.
So how do you determine which truck is right for your needs?
You know, it really does depend, and it's highly personable. I know that for a lot of people, a truck is a lifestyle purchase. And in fact, most car manufacturers are very clear that the majority of their truck sales are luxury models because those trucks allow people to go kind of from work to date night. They can take, you know, their boss or clients in it, and it's still a very nice interior, but then they have the power and the bed that they need for the other activities that they're doing. But if you're really looking for a truck, I would strongly encourage everybody to just kind of get the minimum truck that you need, because a lot of the times people will overbuy on the truck thinking, I might get a bigger boat, or I might trade from these jet skis up to this boat, or maybe we'll get a horse, or yeah, we go to the lake once a year. I need to, you know, I'll need to tow something. What that means though is, like, if you're thinking about something that you only do a couple of times a year, you're paying for that truck the entirety
throughout
of the year.
And yeah.
Throughout the year, in terms of insurance, in terms of purchase costs, in terms of gas. So really look for the minimum truck you can get, especially if it's going to be your only car. Now, if you have like five or six cars and you're not driving the truck every day, you know, you go do you. Do what you want.
Well, let's pause right there with Editor-in-Chief at Car Talk, Jamie Page Deaton. And you're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kelly Blue Book says the pricing gap between gas-powered cars and electric vehicles is rapidly closing as manufacturers display new vehicles and prototypes at auto shows this month in Chicago and Milwaukee. We discuss your questions and comments about models, about features, pricing. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jamie Page Deaton is editor-in-chief of Car Talk. Let's bring in Susan in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Hi, Susan. What would you like to ask?
Hi, good morning. I am going to be purchasing a van to convert into a camper van, kind of a garage for my toys when I pull my camper. So something that can be turned into a camper van and also that can tow, let's say, 5,000 pounds. What are your thoughts on these vans?
Susan, thank you. And converting, Jamie, go ahead.
Yeah, this is a really popular thing now that a lot of people are doing, Susan. And some of the most common vans that we see people converting into camper vans are the Mercedes-Benz Sprinter and the Ram Sprinter vans. And the reason that a lot of people like these vans is compared to other vans like a Chevy Express or a Ford, you know, E-Series van, these Sprinter vans tend to be a little bit taller. So you can actually stand up inside. The other nice thing about these vans is you can get them pretty much empty, where they're just a metal shell. So you can put in your own changes very, very easily without necessarily having to pull out a lot of features that the manufacturer installed. That's why these vans are really popular with tradespeople, because they're able to put in, you know, the toolboxes and things that work for them. So I'd really highly recommend either a new or a used Ram Sprinter or a Mercedes-Benz Sprinter. And don't let the Mercedes-Benz label you know, scare you off with the price. They're still very good, very basic vans. And the reason that I'm using the two kind of interchangeable, and you may have noticed that they're both called Sprinter vans, is that these vans were made in a partnership between the two automakers. So they're largely the same. So if you can find a Ram Sprinter or if you can find a Mercedes Sprinter, just go for the one that has the features and the best price for you, because they're pretty much identical.
Susan, does that help?
It does. And what do I need to look for to tow 5,000 pounds? Anything with a transmission or...
No, I mean, and you'll need to look at the combination of the engine and the transmission, and the vans come to, you know, they'll come with towing packages just like trucks. And these types of cargo vans are built on to truck frames. So they do have, you know, the strength and the towing capacity of a lot of the larger trucks, but you will need to get likely a towing package to make sure that you have, you know, the hitch and everything that you need. But for most of these vans, like almost any trim level, you won't be going really fast, but you'll also be able to tow that much.
Susan, thanks for the call. Happy trails. Let's turn to minivans, Jamie. Car Talk named its best minivans for 2024. Honda Odyssey tops the list. Why is the Honda Odyssey the best minivan to buy right now?
It's just a great all-around van. I mean, there is, I will say, there are no bad minivans on the market just because there are so, you know, few minivans on the market. The ones that are left are really, really good. But the Honda Odyssey, in comparison to the other vans, has a ton of super practical features and space. And you can get it with a built-in vacuum cleaner.
Yep.
You can get it with a special night vision camera that lets you see into the back seat. So which is great for night road trips if you want to just check in and see, you know, make sure the kids are asleep, things like that, without having to turn around. But what's interesting about it and why I think most automotive writers love it is because out of all the minivans on the market, it's the most fun to drive, which I know sounds really strange when we're talking about a minivan. And while it's certainly no sports car, out of all the vans in the market, it's best at getting out of its own way. It can handle turns much more easily and much, you know, more stably, and honestly, a lot more fun. So the Honda Odyssey just kind of ticks all the boxes that you need to tick for being a minivan, but then it adds in that, hey, I'm fun to drive too. That really makes a lot of people love it.
So is Chrysler's Pacifica still the only minivan where the seats in the second and third rows can be folded down and you get that flat floor?
Well, you can get the flat floor with any minivan. The difference is the Pacificas, you can get them so that they fold into the floor, whereas with other minivans, that second row seats, you have to manually pull out, and then the third row folds into the floor. So it's one of those things where it's like, if you've got space in your garage and you're reasonably certain that like mice aren't going to make a nest in the upholstery of your seats if you leave them there, then other minivans will work just fine for you. The other thing that I would really encourage you, if you're looking for a minivan, put that third row seat down and see just how much space there is with the second row seat still in there. There is always going to be a ton of space if you don't need the third row. I have large, large dogs, and we have no problem putting, you know, two large dog crates in the back of a minivan when the third row is stowed. And then we still have space, you know, for all the passengers and suitcases and what have you. So really, you only need to remove those second row seats if you're hauling plywood or, you know, if you're heading out to IKEA or going antiquing and buying furniture.
But how did you know?
Yeah, exactly. Trust me, I've seen it. But if you're just going on a road trip, you'll probably have enough space. Even with the third row in place, what I think a lot of people don't realize is when the third row of a minivan is in place, there's a deep cargo well behind it that the seat would fold into. But that gives you a ton of space for storage. So you can stack up just an absolute monster amount of suitcases. So if you think about, you know, minivans will have a capacity of, you know, seven people. It's very easy to get seven large suitcases in a minivan for everybody who's riding along with you.
All right. So let's turn to the Kia Carnival. You know, Car Talk calls it the best budget and luxury minivan. How can a minivan get both distinctions?
Well, so the Kia Carnival has, you know, one of the lowest starting prices of any minivan on the market for a new one. But it also comes, you know, in typical Kia fashion with a ton of luxury features. And the one that really impressed my kids the most, and this is an option, was the second row captain's chairs are actually recliners with actual footrests and everything. You know, there are a grand total of 9 USB chargers throughout the cabin. So everybody's got, you know, space to not only keep their devices plugged in, but even backups plugged in. And there's, you know, you can skip the rear seat entertainment system because there are so many USB ports. But just overall, for the price, it's a really nice van that in terms of features and finishes competes with much more expensive ones like the Toyota Sienna.
Jamie Page Deaton is here, editor-in-chief of Car Talk, as we discuss the latest models and car brands. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Jamie, while we're on minivans, watching the Super Bowl last night, and Volkswagen teased its electric ID. Buzz minivan, can you tell us anything about this throwback and what it might be?
Yeah, this is really interesting, and it actually ties really nicely back to our discussion on concepts, because when this was initially introduced a few years ago as a concept, people were saying there's no way they're ever going to make this, because it basically looks like the old hippie Volkswagen buses went and maybe got a little bit of Botox, like some nice work done, and has just been kind of modernized with this electric powertrain. And it looks really practical. You know, you could use it. You know, there's various configurations you can get it in. I think most people will get it as kind of a passenger van, which makes a lot of sense for most people. Although, you know, Susan, if you're still listening, there might be a camping version if you're willing to go electric, but odds are it won't tow 5,000 pounds. But just overall, a lot of people are really excited about it, first for the looks, and then second because, you know, for a lot of minivans, they're just used around town. And so for people who are looking to, you know, cut their carbon emissions from their driving, having an electric van when they're only driving, you know, 30 to 40 miles a day. And trust me, the range on this will be a lot longer. But just overall, you know, they're not, you're not going to have range anxiety driving around town, and you're going to be able to handle all of your family's, you know, carpooling and kind of kid needs while also looking really, really cool and not emitting any kind of, you know, CO2 at the tailpipe, because the car doesn't have a tailpipe. So just overall, it's looking like it's going to be just a really fun kind of jolt to the minivan market, because right now there is no electric minivan. You can get a plug-in hybrid Chrysler Pacifica, which will get you about 30 miles of electric only range before the gas engine, you know, clicks in. But it's nowhere near as cool as this ID Buzz is. So this is one that, you know, I'm really excited to see, really excited to get behind the wheel of. And I would, if you're in the market for a van, I would wait just to give a test drive to this one, because it is so cool.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there are no fully electric minivans out there on the market yet. And it's like, I wonder if this will finally kind of push that competition, or why can't we go EV in minivans?
You know, it's really strange that we haven't, just because, you know, minivans make a lot of sense. They hold a lot of people, but they don't weigh as much as an SUV that would carry the same amount of people and cargo. And so they make sense as an EV because they're just efficient that way. There's less weight for the batteries and electric motor to haul around. But the other thing to remember is minivans are not popular right now. I mean, the people who are in the car market, I think a lot of them were driven around in minivans, and they see them as, that's my mom's car, so I don't want them. And so, you know, minivans aren't that popular. And so it doesn't make sense for a lot of automakers to put a lot of research and development into electric powertrains for their vans. Now, this Volkswagen ID Buzz, it's coming, you know, for a little bit more of a European market, where MPVs, which are, you know, multi-passenger vehicles, these small vans, are, you know, much more common. I mean, American minivans are absolutely gargantuan, despite having mini in their name, when you go overseas and you see the smaller vans that people are using. So it makes sense for Volkswagen to put this in, and it ties in really nicely to kind of their counterculture heritage. But just overall, in America, we see a lot more EV SUVs, because those are the types of vehicles that automakers know that they can make their money on.
Editor-in-Chief of Car Talk, Jamie Page Deaton, touring us through the latest news and news on used and new cars. How about that? Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Car enthusiasts will flock to auto shows like Chicago and Milwaukee this month. We discuss new car features with Car Talk's editor-in-chief, Jamie Page Deaton. And you can join in with your question. You can add your perspective, 800-642-1234. Jamie, Toyota's chairman says the appeal of electric vehicles is limited and predicts that fully electric vehicles will grow to a maximum of 30% of the car market. Do you think, is Toyota right to be skeptical of fully electric vehicles?
You know, it's interesting, because a lot of people, you know, think about, when they think about Toyota, they think about the Prius, which was, you know, really a leader in bringing electrified, so not fully electric, but with some electric components, you know, vehicles to market. And so you would think that Toyota would be leading the charge to a fully electric future for mobility. And that's not really the case. And I think, you know, what he's talking about here is a couple of different things. Most importantly being, you know, infrastructure has not caught up with what, you know, what needs to happen in order for everyone to switch over from a gas vehicle to an electric vehicle. Charging times can still take, you know, 20 minutes to an hour just to get, you know, 80% of charge on a vehicle. And there aren't enough charging stations, and they're often broken, and they might not work with your particular, you know, electric vehicle. And so that makes it really, really difficult for people, particularly people who don't live in single family homes, to adopt an electric vehicle as part of your lifestyle. And, you know, Toyota's been very clear about this for a long time, but they see EVs as just one part of overall kind of mobility solutions. Toyota's done a lot of work around hydrogen-fueled vehicles and even some liquefied natural gas vehicles. So Toyota's really trying to cover all of their bases here. And it'll be interesting to see if, you know, if he's correct. Now, the U.S. government has invested a lot of money in providing incentives for people to buy electric vehicles, but much less money in the actual infrastructure required. So, you know, it might make sense now for governments, instead of giving incentives to buyers, to, you know, give incentives to businesses to put in electrical vehicle charging stations, or, you know, gas stations to add charging stations in addition to their fuel pumps to help people make this transition. But I will say, one of the things that I think Toyota is missing here is there's not infrastructure for other alternative fuel types either. I mean, up in New England, we would see some, you know, LNG vehicles, and there were, you know, two.
Liquefied LNG, natural gas.
Yeah, liquefied natural gas. Like, there were two stations where you could get that fuel, you know, in the region. You know, the hydrogen fuel stations, I think there was one in Southern California. Maybe there's been some additions there. But it's just, infrastructure is a real issue. And you know, to be honest, none of us is going to remember this, but we've been through this before when we transitioned from horses to cars, right? It used to be that there was a, you know, a stable in every town where you could
hitching
rent a spot
post,
for your horse.
Yeah,
yeah, hitching post, you know, that kind of thing. And that was replaced by the gas station. And so it's going to take a while this kind of shakes out. But I would expect for a long, long time, you're going to have a lot of options. But overwhelmingly, the easiest one for a while is going to be a gas-powered car, because simply the infrastructure is in place.
Interesting. Let's bring in Greg in Madison. Greg, go ahead.
Good morning, Jamie. I wanted to mention I went to the Chicago Auto Show on Saturday. And it's interesting that you would just mention what you were talking about with Toyota and the infrastructure for EVs. And my question was, I own an EV. I love it. I drive it every day. I got 26,000 miles on it in a year. So and I have some other ICE engine cars. But my question is, it seems like there might be this power struggle between, are we going to push towards electric cars, or is the ICE engine going to just be the car we continue to buy? So I know you just talked about Toyota and they're not headed that way, but it's interesting you should just talk about it. I was just going to ask you that question.
Well, it's, you know, there is what I call, like, you know, door number three, which is a little bit of a secret door here. And that is plug-in hybrids, which a lot of people are not aware of, but a number of automakers have them. And what these cars are, and it's, you know, I mentioned the Chrysler Pacifica hybrid. There's a Toyota Prius Prime, a Toyota RAV4 that does this. A number of Volvos do this. And that is, when you have a plug-in hybrid, you plug the car in and it's got a full-on electric motor, and it gives you roughly 30 to 40 miles of all electric range, which means that when you're doing your around town driving, you know, your car at the tailpipe is not emitting any CO2. And the reason I say at the tailpipe is because whether or not your car is still contributing to global CO2 emissions depends on where you get your electricity from. So if you're getting it from a coal-fired plant, well, your car may not be as clean as you think it is. But if you have, you know, full-on solar power, then it's pretty clean. But what is great about these plug-in hybrids is when the electric power is depleted, then the gas engine kicks in. So you can go 30 miles with, you know, no emissions from your car directly. And then, you know, you've got this backup engine. So it really eliminates the need to stress over, you know, if I'm on this, will there be a charger? Will the charger be working? Because you've always got that gas station as kind of a backup. And this is a really great option for people who want to go electric, but aren't really ready yet, or if they do, you know, a lot of driving into areas where the infrastructure isn't there yet. This allows you to kind of have your cake and eat it too. And the other great thing about these cars is a lot of times the electric motor can also jump in to enhance performance. So there's a Volvo V60 station wagon. It's their Polestar model. And it's nearly 500 horsepower for a Volvo station wagon, and nearly 500 pound feet of torque. So this thing It gets, you know, 35 miles of all electric range, and it could actually absolutely smoke any other car at the drag strip. And it just makes these cars just a really smart option if you're looking to cut your emissions, but aren't ready to go fully electric yet. So if you're in the market for a new car and you're thinking electric, go check out a plug-in hybrid, because it can effectively be a vehicle that's going to bridge the gap while infrastructure and, you know, charging times and battery tech gets sorted out.
Well, Abraham from Fitchburg has a question on California passing a bill that says all cars must be electric by 2035. What could that look like, and how would it affect other states?
So California, just given its size and the size of the marketplace, it has an outsized impact on the new car market. I mean, fuel standards are basically set by California because automakers cannot ignore California as a marketplace, or they do so kind of at their peril. So what it could mean for other states is increased, you know, faster adoption of electric vehicles, because there's going to be more money poured into research and more money poured into developing these new models for the California market, and the rest of the country can take advantage of it. Now, the question really is, you know, are automakers going to be able to meet this law? Are they going to push back on it? Excuse me. What type of lobbying are, you know, dealers in California going to push against this law? Because there's one kind of unspoken thing about electric vehicles, and that's that car dealers absolutely hate them because they require so much less maintenance than a gas engine car. And that's where most car dealers are making most of their money. And so, you know, full on adoption of electric vehicles is not good for car dealers or really anybody who owns, you know, a shop. So this will be really interesting to see if this law actually goes into effect. But overall, what we can expect if it does is more options for more consumers, because California really kind of points the U.S. car market in the direction that it's going to go.
I just want to land here quickly on the used market for electric vehicles. What is that like? Do electric vehicles hold their resale values?
Not really, which is great if you're looking for a used electric vehicle, because the battery technology keeps leapfrogging, which is why, you know, if you're looking at an EV, you might want to lease it. I normally don't recommend that people lease cars, but if you're looking at getting one new, lease it, because the battery technology is going to be different when your lease is over. And you don't want to be stuck with a car that's going to have bad resale value. Now, the flip side of that is if you're looking for an EV, the used market can be a great place to get some amazing deals. So a lot of people don't know this, but VW had an electric Golf, which is their little hatchback, for the longest time. And you can get those for under $12,000. Same with the Nissan Leaf, which is kind of the OG electric vehicle. It was the first mass market one that rolled out in the US. You can get those for less than $10,000. You know, the range on them is about 100 miles, so not great. But if you're just looking for an around town car, a used EV makes a really good option.
Jamie, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jamie Page Deaton is editor-in-chief of Car Talk. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.